take your time setting up. Each of you has 15 minutes for presentation of your case. An additional 5 minutes is reserved to the commissioner. If you choose to use that for rebuttal purposes, please state your name and indicate who you're speaking on behalf of when you approach the podium.
May it please the court, I'm Anthony Noss, Assistant Attorney General, and I represent the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Services in this appeal. The Commissioner respectfully requests that this court reverse the Commitment Appeal Panel's order granting Mr. Swedeen's petition for discharge from civil commitment because the panel's ultimate conclusions are not supported by the evidence as a whole. When this court reviews the substantive merits of the Commitment Appeal Panel's decision on a petition for a reduction in custody after a phase two hearing, it reviews such a decision for clear error, examining the record to determine whether the evidence as a whole sustains the panel's findings. This court recently clarified that that is, in fact, the standard of review that this court applies in the Edwards decision cited in the commissioner's brief. Legal questions, however, are reviewed de novo. This court should reverse the panel's order because its ultimate conclusions are not supported by the evidence as a whole. First, the substantive legal standard. The relevant statute is Minnesota Statute Section 253D.31, which says in part that a committed person shall not be discharged unless it appears to the satisfaction of the panel that the committed person is capable of making an acceptable adjustment to open society, is no longer dangerous to the public, and is no longer in need of treatment and supervision.
How do we reconcile the fact that this panel hears the testimony of, I think it was three experts that testified, and it seems as if they were all straightforward in their determination, or at least their opinion, that he was a juvenile at the time and there was a likelihood that there would not be recidivism? I mean, I don't know let me ask you this question. I'd rather state it this way. What do you think is your strongest point that was presented to the appeal panel that would support continued confinement of this individual?
Well, necessarily, Your Honor, the commissioner will have to address both of the call prongs, which is kind of the lens through which the statute must be read. The strongest evidence, the set of evidence that really goes to both prongs, is that, as I believe Mr. Schiffer testified, Mr. Swedeen is essentially the same person as he was when he walked through the doors of MSOP when he got committed. There's still that same constellation of behaviors and psychological symptoms that are in place for him.
So Schiffer was the therapist, right?
He is the, I believe his title is clinical court supervisor. He was voicing the position of the clinical leadership.
And I recall the language, you know, it would be premature to discharge. Is it Sweden? Sweden?
I believe it's Swedeen, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, I have no doubt that counsel for the respondent will tell me how to pronounce it correctly. You know, I thought, Mr. Noss, do I get that correctly?
That's correct.
You know, I thought your brief was very, very well done and had some very good points. But the one thing I didn't see anywhere in the brief that you wrote was that it was the commissioner who had the burden of proving by clear and convincing evidence that the individual shouldn't be discharged. First of all, do I correctly state that you had the burden under that standard of proof?
That is correct, Your Honor. I would have expected that I put that in.
Well, no, actually, if I were you, I wouldn't have put it in.
Oh.
Because that's the biggest problem you've got. So I thought you did a very nice job, but fortunately I've got very good clerks and, you know, they reminded me.
Well, Your Honor, if that was not in the brief, I apologize.
No, I'm not trying to criticize you. I'm trying to compliment you. But I think the biggest flaw is that. So let's sort of try this. Let's toss out, and I hope I get all their names right, let's toss out all the testimony under that burden of power and Tippett, okay, right? The experts for the individual. And let's take a look at just Thornton and Schiffer. So Thornton is the one who's got the advanced degrees, right?
Well, Your Honor, I believe the
record... He's a psychologist? I mean, he's got more degrees than Schiffer.
The record reflects Dr. Thornton has a doctoral degree and Mr. Schiffer has a master's degree.
Okay, well, there you go. So one's a doctor. So presumably that was your key, well, your more credentialed expert. And he testifies that juveniles have sort of 3 to 12% chance of likely to reoffend. Is that a fair statement?
Not exactly, Your Honor.
Okay.
If I may.
Because it's weaker than that?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
I believe Dr. Thornton's testimony is more accurately described as there's this sort of general base rate for juvenile-only offenders that these meta-studies or meta-analyses looked at, and I think that is more the 3%-ish or so rate. But Dr. Thornton testified about how...
And it's D. Thornton?
I'm sorry.
D.T. Dr. Thornton?
Thornton.
Okay. Well, let's say for the sake of argument, he did testify conclusively that juveniles only have a 3 to 12% reoffense rate. That means they have an 88% not likely to reoffend. So under that burden of proof, when your guy, if he's saying this, is saying that the individual... That individuals like this person are 88% likely not to reoffend, how on earth have you met your burden?
First, Your Honor, I don't want to let this one fact go. The record reflects that Dr. Thornton testified that the closer to the 12% rate is more accurate or more applicable.
You know, let's say it's 12%.
Okay. Understood. I mean,
but that means it's 88% the other way. So if it's 88% the other way, how have you met your burden? When it's clear and convincing, I mean, it seems to me it's clear and convincing that you didn't. So why am I wrong? And I often am.
Your Honor, the second call prong is whether the person still remains dangerous. Mm-hmm. It's not...
And don't we look at likely to reoffend dangerous? I mean, that was always my understanding. Perhaps I'm wrong.
Well, it's not whatever the highly likely, or I believe the standard is for coming in the door on commitment. That's not what we're talking about for sure, because it's just the reasonable relation. So it sounds like the court's question is saying, is the burden of proof, insofar as we can ascribe a numerical number to that, like 51% or something, or clear and convincing as something higher, is that what we need to prove, a percentage?
Well, no, you have to prove by clear and convincing evidence he shouldn't be discharged, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So... Where in Dr. Thornton's testimony do I find the testimony that, you know, he is likely to reoffend and he is a danger to society if he gets out? Where would I find that?
In part, it's based on the numerical analysis that Dr. Thornton said.
Are we now back to the 3 to 12%? That means it's 88% the other way. So that seems like a loser to me.
Your Honor, the commissioner needs to prove by clear and convincing evidence that he remains dangerous to the public.
Right.
So where
did you prove that? Through Dr. Thornton?
Through the recidivism rate testimony of Dr. Thornton, and more importantly...
Which is only 12%.
That's one part of the dangerousness analysis,
Where's
Your
the
Honor.
Other part?
The other part is that regardless of which set of base rates, the 3%... Mm-hmm. or 12% or whatever applies, Dr. Thornton also testified about how one of the methods of risk assessment that's endorsed by the American Psychological Association is when you look at the factors contributing to the original offending and then look at whether evidence of those factors continue to manifest themselves when the person is an adult. I would stress here for the court that I think there was a footnote in the commissioner's reply brief to the Ince case, where the Supreme Court noted that the determination of dangerousness is neither purely a clinical prediction nor simply a matter for statisticians.
Absolutely, I you're, you know, you're, you got me there. So I mean, here I'm looking at his testimony. You know, over the last few years, he's sexually preoccupied. He's still impulsive and depressive. Shows poor regulation. You know, that all sounds bad. On the other hand, this is your guy. He is, in fact, somewhat older, and his offenses were, in fact, some years, now 17 years ago. So my conclusion is, frankly, we don't know. Well, frankly, we don't know doesn't sound like, yep, he's going to do it. You know, and then the applicable base rate of recidivism might be around 12% or something, and so somebody who was high risk relative to that would have a substantial risk of reoffending. The applicable base rate might be as low as 3%, in which case somebody would have a much lower risk, and I don't think we're in a position to tell which of those things apply. Well, if we don't, how have you met clear and convincing? I mean, that's just like saying, on the one hand, you know, he might, and then on the other hand, he might not. Well, if that's what I'm getting out of this, then boy, that isn't clear and convincing. And clear and convincing is, you know what? This guy, all indicators indicate problems. Now, where am I looking at? Where is the really great information other than that that says, yep, likely to reoffend, boy, oof, don't let him out?
Your Honor, if I may
go right ahead.
Follow up on something that Your Honor just said. I believe this, frankly, we cannot know language or whatever he said was really something that the panel grasped onto, and it's something that...
Something I'm grasping on. My hunch is my colleagues have somewhat aware of that.
Now, that related to which follow-up group, or essentially these two different base rate groups applied, the sort of the 3% rate or something more.
It had to do but with whether you're a juvenile if you're going to be continuing into adulthood with those tendencies.
I believe that was part of the analysis of which group, Your Honor. So the frankly we cannot know language or whatever he said was in relation to which of those groups of recidivism rates would apply. Dr. Thornton wasn't equivocating as to whether or not his opinion was that Mr. Swedeen remained dangerous. So
Dr. Thornton did say that Swedeen exhibited episodic hypersexuality, and my review of the record shows that is his greatest and best concern as far as harm, that he hasn't had any experience dating or otherwise, and he has this hypersexuality focus.
Your Honor, I do know that is one thing that Dr. Thornton did bring up, but that is only a small part of his analysis. Again,
but I couldn't find anything else that said the danger part that you're alluding to. That was all I could find in his testimony that had any, he talked about thing that's behavior points that I think are very typical with anyone who's been incarcerated or been in confinement, that he's ill-equipped to get a job, that he doesn't necessarily get along with supervisors and fellow workers, but isn't that people that are institutionalized generally, you have those traits?
Your Honor, the testimony from all of the experts, including Dr. Tippett and Dr. Powers, and theirs was in the context of the PTSD diagnosis, at least Dr. Powers' was, I think they all support that what's going on with Mr. Swedeen in terms of behavioral actions and psychological symptoms is something more than just the sort of general antisocial behaviors that a sex offender might have. They all gave him some sort of disorder. They relate to his ability to cope, his disregard for rules, he's got these anger issues. There's more going on here than just someone who's had a tough time.
Correct me if I'm wrong, though, but didn't both Dr. Powers and Dr. Tippett opine that those behavior issues didn't necessarily reflect a risk of reoffense, that there were other explanations for those behavior issues that weren't tied to sexual offending?
Your Honor, I believe that's accurate, that they didn't think that his behaviors had a connection to sexual dangerousness.
And given the deferential standard of review and the panel's, that the panel found those two experts to be credible and didn't find Dr. Thornton's opinion to be credible, you know, on what basis could this court find that it was an error for the panel to rely on those two, or to find that those two experts' opinions were more credible than Dr. Thornton's? Because you're basically asking us to find that Dr. Thornton's opinion was more credible than their opinions, it seems to me. But correct me if I'm wrong.
Your Honor, the commissioner is asking the court to look at Dr. Tippett's and Dr. Powers's conclusions as found by the court and the court's, and the, I'm sorry, in the panel's overall conclusions as not being supported by the evidence as a whole. So although let's assume that Dr. Tippett and Powers, Your Honor, I may go slightly over my time to answer your question.
Please answer a question, sure. But yes, you now are officially out of time.
Thank you, Your Honor. So even assuming that that was the essence of maybe their testimony for the second call prong, that those opinions are just not supported by the record as a whole, because again, there's this constellation of behaviors and psychological symptoms that are the same or similar as were when he was initially committed. So
thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
We'll have 5 minutes for a rebuttal.
May it please the court. My name is Jill Avery. I'm an attorney with Templeman Law, and we represent the respondent in this matter, Isaiah Swedeen. The commitment appeal panel did not clearly err when they granted Mr. Swedeen's petition for discharge from civil commitment. The evidence as a whole supports the panel's findings, and we ask this court today to affirm the decision of the panel granting Mr. Swedeen a discharge. I wanted to start off today by talking about a couple cases. The Edwards and the Kirchhoff cases, they were decided by the Court of Appeals on the same day by the same panel of judges with differing results. Now, the commissioner is focused on the Edwards case as being instructive in this matter, but instead the Kirchhoff case is the one that should be used as instruction. These two cases were a little difficult to reconcile because in one case you have the Edwards case where he had the support of eyewitness, and the Court of Appeals reversed the decision. And in the Kirchhoff case, Mr. Kirchhoff had 5 witnesses, nobody who supported him, yet the Court of Appeals affirmed that decision. But I think these two cases have to be understood in the type of case they are and the burden that is associated with each type of case. The Edwards case was a CPS transfer case, and in that instance, the petitioner has the burden of proof by a preponderance of the evidence to prove that transfer should be granted. And this is more likely than not. And when Mr. Edwards had 4 witnesses, and one of them was in support of him, but that was very lukewarm, you can just see by numerical analysis, without taking any credibility or weighing decisions into it, that he had a long way to go to meet that evidence level. And the evidence as a whole, and again, it's evidence as a whole, it's not reweighing the evidence, it's not determining credibility, it's looking at it strictly as an evidence as a whole, that Mr. Edwards didn't meet the burden. The Kirchhoff case, on the other hand, which was decided the same day, is similar to Mr. Swedeen's case because Mr. Kirchhoff had the first burden to put forth a prima facie case for provisional discharge. And at that point, the burden shifted to the commissioner to prove by clear and convincing evidence that the discharge should not be granted. Clear and convincing evidence is more than a preponderance, but less than beyond reasonable doubt. And so just for numerical purposes, I'm gonna say 70 to 80%. None of the 5 witnesses on their face appeared to support Mr. Kirchhoff's provisional discharge. But when the panel looked at the other evidence, also the testimony of these witnesses that supported Mr. Kirchhoff in that he was making good progress in treatment. He was participating wholeheartedly. He was in arousal management. He was on many outings without incident. They chipped away at that apparent high number that the commissioner had appeared to have made and brought it down to less than clear and convincing. And at that point, the Court of Appeals agreed and said, It's not whether they could have come to a different decision. It's whether the panel clearly erred in making the decision. And the Court of Appeals agreed that they had not met that burden. And this same burden applies in Mr. Swedeen's case. So the Edwards case is beneficial for setting or clarifying the standard of review in these types of cases, but it's not instructive for our purposes. In the Swedeen case, Mr. Swedeen had to prove, the commissioner had to prove by clear and convincing evidence two things: that Mr. Swedeen needed treatment and supervision for his sexual disorder, and also that Mr. Swedeen continued to pose a risk of reoffense to the public. There were two witnesses, Dr. Tippett and Dr. Powers, who were unequivocal in their support of Mr. Swedeen's discharge. There was also Dr. Thornton and MSOP who did not. So just taking your numerical analysis, you can see that the commissioner still had a long way to go to prove clear and convincing evidence in either topic. It's important to note that MSOP is not a risk assessor, and they do not share an opinion as to whether Mr. Swedeen had a likelihood of reoffense. So in the case of the treatment and supervision, we might say 50-50 without any credibility determinations. But then when you get to the risk of reoffense, it's lower. It's only maybe 30%. And that's before you take into account the credibility determinations. And I think the commissioner forgets that the panel determined Dr. Thornton to not be credible. Dr. Thornton was paid by the commissioner to appear. The commitment appeal panel has to review certain evidence, and that includes the SRB treatment report, the sexual violence risk assessment report of Dr. Tippett, and also the court-appointed examiner's report and opinion. The commissioner then hired Dr. Thornton to testify against Mr. Swedeen, and Dr. Thornton did not read the report of Dr. Powers. He didn't speak to anybody at MSOP other than Kayla Taylor, Mr. Swedeen's primary therapist, who is not trained in PTSD. He did not speak to Dr. Crystal Leal, who had been recently hired.
Do you know if he asked to speak with Mr. Swedeen?
He did. He may have asked, but Mr. Swedeen did not agree, because this is not a required examination. Mr. Swedeen has nothing to gain by being examined by the commissioner's expert. The panel determined that Dr. Thornton was not credible. It wasn't that he was less credible. He was not credible. And this is supported by the evidence as a whole. Dr. Thornton diagnosed Mr. Swedeen without ever meeting with him, without ever talking to him, with antisocial personality disorder. Mr. Swedeen has never in his life had that diagnosis, even by MSOP. Dr. Thornton didn't believe that Mr. Swedeen had PTSD, even though he had endured a childhood of extreme child sexual abuse and neglect, and even though Dr. Tippett, Dr. Powers, and MSOP all agreed that Mr. Swedeen had PTSD. The panel also determined that Dr. Thornton's opinion relative to Mr. Swedeen's treatment needs was not credible. Dr. Thornton's opinion was that Mr. Swedeen needed treatment for a sex offender because he had antisocial personality disorder, the diagnosis that nobody had ever made. Dr. Thornton also testified that Mr. Swedeen needed treatment for hypersexuality, even though that had never been a diagnosis and MSOP had never identified that as a treatment need. Dr. Thornton also testified that Mr. Swedeen had a very high risk of recidivism, relatively high risk of recidivism compared to other juvenile-only offenders. And the panel did not find that credible. Dr. Thornton.
Counsel, on that last point, mm-hmm. What did Dr. Thornton base that conclusion on?
There is a study. It was an unnamed study that Dr. Thornton had read. In this study, the study found that the base rate was higher for this group that was studied, higher than the three, and there was a multiplier. Dr. Thornton wasn't sure exactly what the multiplier was, and he needed to do some more work on that. But he said maybe it was like 4%. So applying the 4 to the 3% low base rate, he came up with the number of 12. Now, this study was based on a group of juveniles who had been had sex offended when they were juveniles, and then there was a period of time after this offense but before they came adults, and those records were not known. And so they speculated that during that time, there was a higher risk because they're juveniles that are more apt to act out. But that did not fit Mr. Swedeen. Mr. Swedeen's risk of recidivism was known since the time he self-reported at age 15. They knew his records, and they knew that he has not done anything sexually offensive, sexually abusive, and he, for the last 10 years, has been in a facility with sex offenders and pedophiles, and he has not acted out. His recidivism rate has been zero.
The state argues that his behavior indicates that he's and I, if I get this wrong, I apologize, but he's essentially the same person as he was when he entered MnSOP, and that indicates that he has a risk, or he's, that treatment is needed and there's a risk of reoffense.
We don't disagree that treatment is needed, but it's PTSD treatment. And as Dr. Tippett and Dr. Thornton stated, that his behavior is a result of PTSD. It is not associated, his past offending is not associated with his behavior. His past offending was due to the fact that he was a sexual abuse victim, and they just continued. When these children were first put in foster care and then moved into their adoptive home, they all acted out together, or they all sexually acted out or participated. And at some point that changed, but it wasn't something that these children hadn't learned. And Mr. Swedeen was the oldest of the children. He was the one that endured the longest time of abuse. And so at 15, he did self-report. Now, he does have these maladaptive behaviors, but that's not a reason that you commit somebody, is because they act out. Maybe they swear, maybe they get angry. These symptoms that they're talking about, they could be a lot of different things, and they could be typical juvenile behavior. I mean, think of a teenager who acts out, and that's what he's doing. He has never been treated for PTSD until after the SRB hearing recently. At MSOP, it had never been identified that he was supposed to get treatment for that. So he's just started getting some treatment for his PTSD. I also want to talk about these...
Ms. Avery, your client is 31 now. 34, thank you. You know, in looking at response brief, there is, and going to Judge Cochran's point, there is a lot of write-ups, you know, from 2019, possession of contraband, verbal assaults, I'm not going to follow the, you know, effing touch policy. I was not going to live by, this effing moral code. That doesn't sound good.
Absolutely.
And that would suggest that maybe he hasn't responded well to treatment, and maybe when he gets out, he is gonna, explode. So what's your response to that, please?
One, he has had no treatment until just recently for PTSD. These are behaviors associated with PTSD. And he needs treatment. He is getting treatment maybe twice a month, and that just started after the SRB hearing, where Templeman Law represented him on a pro bono basis, because for the last 10 years, he has not gotten anything from MSOP. And that doesn't mean, don't excuse him if he still needs sex offender treatment, but he does not need sex offender treatment. As Dr. Powers and Dr. Tippett testified, he does not need that. What he needs is PTSD. He needs intensive treatment, but he needs PTSD treatment. And if he stays at MSOP, he is going to stay the same person that he was, but it has nothing to do with his past reoffending or his future risk of reoffending. I also want to touch on, Commissioner talked about this constellation of symptoms that are similar to his past behavior. Mr. Swedeen was committed as a sexually dangerous person and not as an SPP. Now, an SPP, you have a constellation of symptoms. It's behavior-based, and because of that, you had this high standard that you had to also meet of utter lack of power to control. In the case of Mr. Swedeen, he was committed specifically because of a diagnosis which is required under the SDP Act. A DSM-5 diagnosis is required. And I brought up the fact in my brief that his diagnosis when he was committed, and that's the complete basis that he was committed on, is that he had this diagnosis, and for that reason he offended, and for that reason he had a future risk. Now, my opinion is Mr. Swedeen should never have been committed in the first place, and I think if you look at his original commitment records, that rings true. He was brought up for commitment, and all the doctors agree this person is not SPP or SDP candidate. They walked away and they said, let's let him go to this alpha house, but didn't give him any treatment for PTSD. Of course, he continues to act out. He's never been treated for PTSD. At that point, they all of a sudden decide, yes, he's committable because he acted out. He maybe ran away. He did things that a typical teenager would do because he's got untreated PTSD. Somewhere along the line, this diagnosis disappeared, but that was the reason he was committed. And now... this shifted away and he's no longer got this diagnosis, well, how can you say that he's still the same person? He doesn't have a diagnosis. And with an SPP or MIND person, you don't need a specific diagnosis. You need a constellation of symptoms. And I think we can't confuse those two things in that Mr. Swedeen had a diagnosis. That's the reason he was committed. He no longer has that diagnosis. He now has a better diagnosis, and that he has PTSD.
Feel free to quit while you're ahead.
Yes, okay. I just wanted to sum up that we, you know, this is all about reviewing the evidence as a whole to whether the panel made clear error, which they did not. They did. The commissioner did not meet the level of clear and convincing evidence on either element, much less both. We ask this court, therefore, to affirm the panel's decision to grant Mr. Swedeen's discharge. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Avery.
Your Honors, first of all, I'd just like to clarify that the Commissioner did, in fact, reference the clear and convincing standard on page 36 of the initial brief. I'm sorry if that wasn't prevalent enough. Second, as to this whole issue of the Edwards and Kirchhoff decisions, really, Your Honors, it's not about the factual situations in those two cases. The thing to focus on from those two decisions is the standard of review and that it is the record as a whole review. Moving on, Ms. Avery just stated, I believe, in part, that Mr. Swedeen should never have been committed in the first place. Finally, we learn what it appears Mr. Swedeen's real core of his argument is that he doesn't think he ever should have been committed. But that's not what the legal issue is before this court. The inquiry here is not whether he could meet the incoming criteria again. It's whether there's that reasonable relation that the call case discusses still in place today. And the commissioner has established by clear and convincing evidence that there is.
What evidence is there that he needs sex offender treatment? I mean, I think... both parties, both sides would agree that he needs treatment, but what evidence is there that he needs sex offender treatment?
So, Your Honor, if I may, that's not the requirement here is that he needs treatment and supervision for a sexual personality or other mental disorder or dysfunction that relates to sexual offending. This term, sex offender-specific treatment, I think was brought up in the hearing with Drs. Tippett and Dr. Powers. The commissioner has to prove that he needs treatment and supervision for one of these disorders or dysfunctions that relates to sexual offending. That very well could be, and in fact here, there's evidence that if he needs treatment for PTSD, that does relate to these psychological symptoms and behaviors that are a problem for him. When he was civilly committed.
But why does he need to do that treatment in your program? Why can't he do the PTSD treatment out and about? I mean, generally speaking, you know, when we're looking at the treatment, I think it's a fair statement to say, no, we're looking at the specific sex offender treatment, you know, because he doesn't get it. He still thinks he can do this, you know, blah, 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 blah. And I'm not sure I would go along with he needs treatment and treatment supervision, and even if it's PTSD, you know, that needs to be done in the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. What case says that?
I mean,
there's tons of people walking around getting PTSD treatment, and you know, they're not locked up, right?
Well, Your Honor, the need for the supervision part of that is borne out by his behaviors and psychological symptoms that, again, are the same or similar.
And that's the stuff I was talking about, you know, cursing the staff and the verbal abuse and et cetera, et cetera.
Yes, Your Honor, that would definitely be part of it. And I'd like to remind the court here that I think this was brought up in Mr. Swedeen's brief. There seemed to be a hint that, well, he could get this. it would be better for him if he got PTSD treatment somewhere else, or the PTSD treatment that he can get at MSOP isn't good enough. Well, what facility best meets Mr. Swedeen's treatment needs is not relevant here. That's not part of the legal standard. If this were a petition for a transfer to a non-secure facility, that's a factor there. It's not for discharge. So that's completely irrelevant. Finally, you know, it's Mr. Swedeen is here today wholeheartedly apparently acknowledging that he has PTSD and that he needs treatment for it. The commissioner's reply brief in particular goes through in detail talking about how the PTSD diagnosis, whether you call it PTSD or whether you call it some personality disorder with borderline traits or whatever label is put on it, we're really talking about, the record would show that they're really talking about the same behaviors and symptoms.
You agree it was your burden or the commissioner's burden to show both prongs by clear and convincing evidence, not just the treatment prong. Also the
yes,
risk
Your Honor.
To the public.
Yes, Your Honor. My time is up. Thank you.
Time has expired.
Yeah. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you for appearing today in support of your briefing. A decision will be issued in the statutory time frame. This court has non-oral cases to consider, so we will stand in recess.